From NPR News in Washington, this is Special Coverage. I'm Neil Conan. Less than an hour ago, President Barack Obama finished delivery of his first State of the Union message to Congress. The president spent much of the speech on the economy and the anger and frustration of so many Americans who continue to struggle. He outlined programs to create new jobs, to rein in big banks, and start to reduce the federal deficit. He acknowledged the unpopularity of his health care proposals, but called on Congress not to walk away from changes he insisted are still needed. He spoke repeatedly to the strength and resilience of the American people and our history when we work together to not just survive, but to triumph. In terms of some specifics, he did, as expected, call for a freeze on discretionary non-security spending starting next year, said more money must be found for education, and said this year he would work with the military to bring an end to the policies that prevent gays and lesbians from service in the armed forces. For the past 2 hours, you've been listening to politicians and analysts. Now it's your turn. Tell us what you liked and what you didn't, and please be specific. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Joining us now by phone is Democratic political strategist Donna Brazile. She managed Al Gore's campaign for president and is currently the founder and managing editor of Brazile and Associates. Nice to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Also with us, Republican strategist and former Congressman Vin Weber, a managing partner at Clark and Weinstock. Vin, nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you.
And he's with us by phone from his home in Virginia. Donna Brazile, let me ask begin by asking about the tone of a president whose party just suffered a significant loss in Massachusetts and whose approval ratings continue to drop.
Well, first of all, I thought the president delivered the speech tonight with confidence. He told us the story of where we've been, but he also outlined more steps that are needed to restore economic growth and prosperity in this country. I believe he spoke directly to the anxiety that many Americans are currently feeling about the economy and jobs and the deficit and also the lack of civility here in our nation's capital. He challenged Congress, as you heard him tonight, to put aside the partisanship so we can get things done for the American people. But he led with the economy, I believe, and I thought that the bulk of the speech was devoted to job creation and the foundation that's needed to return this country back to fiscal sanity.
Vin Weber, if there's one policy of the president's that caused some people to question their support for him a year and a bit ago when he was elected, that's the health care proposals. And he asked the American people tonight to take another look now that things have cooled down. I'm not sure when he thought things were going to cool down, but nevertheless, that's what he's asking for. Do you think he can get that through?
I thought what was striking about it was the lack of anything that might change the game on health care. He didn't talk about it till a little bit over a half an hour into the speech, and then he didn't really say anything new. Now, that he doesn't have to. I mean, he stuck to what his position has been all along, but I think for most of the people who have been watching what's going on in the Capitol the last, you know, month, 2 months or more, the main question was, what are we going to do about this issue that has so totally dominated Washington for most of the last 8 and 9 months? And the answer is, well, we're going to continue to do the same thing we've done before. The president didn't really try to change the game there.
Donna Brazile, other people might say he stuck to his guns and says, we need to get this through no matter how unpopular it is.
Well, the president made it clear that he would not walk away from the millions of Americans who not only have lost their health insurance, but those who are struggling to pay their premiums. He said that he will continue this fight, and I think that the one thing that we should not only give him time, but, of course, the leaders on Capitol Hill, is to come up with a package that not only can get through both chambers, but a package that is good enough and solid enough and clearly fiscally sound that will pass both chambers, and that he could take back to the American people and say that this is what we fought for and this is what will help you clearly meet your demands to pay in for health insurance. I think that's the important thing. Congressman, and you, with all due respect, and you know the chamber perhaps more than I do. I've worked up there for a decade, but I don't think the president should have spent too much time laying out any more of the sausage making up on Capitol Hill, but to give the House leaders and the House and Senate leaders an opportunity to work out their differences, hopefully in public, so that he can go to the American people and say that this is what has been produced on your behalf, and this is what we hope will accomplish our task.
Vin?
Well, I understand what Don is saying. I'm not sure that that's what Democrats on the Hill wanted to hear tonight, though. That's been the president's approach up to now. He's basically said, you know, I have a broad outline of what I'd like to accomplish, but I'm going to leave it to Congress to figure out how exactly to get there. My conversations with people on the Hill in both parties the last, you know, week or so sort of led me to believe that what Democrats particularly, to be blunt, wanted to hear tonight was a little more specific direction. Okay, we're not sure how to get done from here, Mr. President. Tell us what you'd like us to do. He didn't do that. He stuck basically with the same position he's taken for the last year about and said, we need to reform health care. You know what I want to accomplish. Now you guys have to make it happen. We'll see. But my conversations with people on Capitol Hill the last week or two have been really conversations about confusion about the way to move forward. I think most people in Congress wanted to see an end to that confusion. They wanted the president to give them a little more specific direction, and he chose to not do that tonight. We'll see how it works out.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. What did you like? What didn't you? Be specific, please. We'll start with David, and David's calling us from Wiggins in Mississippi.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I was very happy to hear the president address job creation in the United States as opposed to overseas, because you go to Walmart, you can't find a pair of shoes made in America, and that's not free trade to me when the consumer has no choice. And I was very glad to hear him at least speak of job creation here and rewarding companies who build their businesses here as opposed to overseas.
And taking away tax credits for companies that send jobs overseas. At the same time, though, Vin Weber, he called for continued free trade agreements with places like South Korea and Colombia.
Well, that was kind of significant. We'll see how far he wants to carry that. But for people that follow the trade debate, that was actually a fairly significant part of the president's speech when he made specific reference to South Korea, Panama, and Colombia. Those are the three free trade agreements that are, if you will, in the queue before the Congress. And they've been stalled, and advocates of freer, more liberal trade have been very frustrated by the fact that there hasn't been a push put behind them. The fact that the president mentioned those three countries tonight was pretty significant.
And Donna Brazil, he did, as David suggests, though, focus on giving tax credits to American companies who hire new people and expand their businesses and finding new ways to support small businesses.
Well, the president understands that in order to get this economy back on track, we need to give small businesses a lifeline of credit so that they can go out and create the jobs that clearly we need in this country. And I thought the proposals that he embraced tonight, especially the bill that was passed in the House, will go a long way toward giving Main Street the investment that they really need so that we can create these good paying jobs. He also talked about the green economy and the tax credits that he proposed last year in the stimulus program and the expansion of some of those credits. So I thought he went a long way in addressing some of our anxiety, but clearly the proof is in the pudding, and most Americans would like to see results and not just listen to the rhetoric.
David, thanks very much for the call. Let's move on next to, this is John, and John's with us from Cato, Minnesota.
Yes, sir. How you guys doing?
Very well.
First of all, wonderful speech. That was amazing. Specifically, my favorite part of the speech was when President Obama called out the Supreme Court for the ruling that they had very recently here.
This on campaign finance reform. And
yes, sir.
Vin Weber, that was kind of an awkward moment as the cameras panned to the black-robed justices there in the front row as the president chided them.
Well, I've never seen it happen before. I mean, for the president to directly challenge the Supreme Court on a recent ruling is unprecedented. I mean, I suppose it's his right, and obviously, that's a ruling that's going to be contentious in the country, but it was not something that we've seen a president do before. Normally, we call them the Supreme Court for a reason. When they rule, the ruling is supposed to be final.
Yeah, but this is a very activist Supreme Court, and the case that I guess the president was referring to, the Citizen United case, it's really a disaster for the American people. It eliminates a century of law and opened the doors to massive influence by corporations and special interests, and it's something that I think, and it applies to unions too, though corporations have vastly more resources. So this was the most political Supreme Court decision since Bush v. Gore, and I don't think it's what we thought Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito meant when they talked in the confirmation hearing process about judicial modesty and respect for precedent.
And Vin Weber, did he make any points when he pointed out that it would expose the system to influence by foreign corporations?
I think that there's a populist sentiment against what the court did, but not a very deep one. And ultimately, it's going to depend on, we're going to have to see what actually happens. My own view is that the predictions about the impact of this court decision have been vastly overblown.
We'll get to see next year. Let's see if we can get another caller quickly in. Rodney with us from Sterling in Virginia.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I thought that he's talking about still pushing for his health care bill. He evidently hasn't got the message that the people don't like it. And it was obvious from before the election, everybody that opposed him said he's never run anything. So it's no surprise that he doesn't give any direction to Congress. He's letting Congress try to do everything. He tells them what he wants, and they've got to figure out how to do it because he doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, here's what he had to say on health care.
Don't walk away from reform. Not now. Not when we are so close. Let us find a way to come together and finish the job for the American people.
President Obama in his State of the Union message. Rodney, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. There are others out there with your view. We want to hear from you what you liked about the president's speech tonight, what you didn't. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Donna Brazile, we know you've got other commitments. We're happy to have had you with us for the last 20 minutes.
And I want to say thank you to Vin Weber. He's one of my favorite conservatives.
You're nice to say so, Donna. I return the compliment, too.
All right. Donna Brazile, a Democratic political strategist, founder and managing director of Brazile and Associates. Vin Weber is going to stay with us for a few minutes, and we're also going to be joined by NPR's Ken Rudin and Mara Liasson. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tonight, President Obama gave his report to Congress and acknowledged that the change he promised may not have come fast enough for many people in America.
I campaigned on the promise of change. Change we can believe in, the slogan went. And right now, I know there are many Americans who aren't sure if they still believe we can change or that I can deliver it.
We're talking about the State of the Union speech this hour. We want to hear what parts of it you liked, what you didn't. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And I wanted to read a couple of emails that we've gotten. This from Teresa. He was not credible that he has the ability to provide the leadership needed to get Congress to truly work together. I'm not sure anyone can bridge the gulf that divides party politics today. Only if Republicans rise to Obama's challenge to govern together and not just be the party of no, will there be hope. And this from Kathy, and she wrote, "What I am most distressed by throughout the past year is the complete unwillingness of our congressional representatives in the House and the Senate to work in a bipartisan way. Since when are we only a two-party fight that gets nothing done?" And Vin Weber, this was a point that the president returned to over and over again. He chided both parties, but nevertheless, he was saying it is time that we need to change the system.
Well, I know that. It's a little frustrating for a Republican, though. You're sitting here with the Democrats have a more dominant control of all branches of government than they've had, than either party has had since the 1960s. And still, their inability to accomplish much in this last year is blamed on the Republicans. I just don't quite get that. Their problem was not simply Republican intransigence. Their problem was that the public reacted against large elements of their agenda. The public reacted badly to the stimulus bill, $800 billion spent stimulus bill that was passed in February, and the public, as we saw through town meetings and everything else, reacted against their proposals on health care reform. And at every stage, the Democrats sort of said, well, this is just Republicans being negative in the party of no, and never realized or never acknowledged that there was genuine public dissatisfaction with the direction they were taking us.
Vin Weber, did you see that there was going to be any prospect of more bipartisanship? We'll get an answer to this question, we'll let you go.
I think that the bad tone, if you want to think about it that way, was set on the stimulus bill. There was an opportunity at the beginning of this administration for a bipartisan approach to stimulus. I do not think it was preordained that all the Republicans were going to oppose the stimulus package. They were concerned about the economy. They knew the president at that time had a 70% approval rating. They wanted to cooperate. It was not handled right, and we ended up polarizing this Congress for the entire year. There still is an opportunity if the president and the Republicans in the Congress decide they want to take a different turn this year to try to come together on some things. The president's ideas about job creation are not ideas that polarize. They may well gain Republican support.
Vin Weber, thanks very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Vin Weber, former member of Congress, now a Republican political strategist and managing partner at Clark and Weinstock. We should, of course, note that there was a Republican response to the State of the Union as well. This from Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, one of those recently elected Republicans, who said that Republicans in Congress have a plan to reform health care without raising taxes.
We will do that by implementing common sense reforms, like letting families and businesses buy health care insurance policies across state lines and ending frivolous lawsuits against doctors and hospitals that drive up the cost of your health care. And our solutions aren't 1,000-page bills that no one has fully read after being crafted behind closed doors with special interests.
Part of the Republican response to the State of the Union message, President Barack Obama's first. And joining us now are Ken Rudin, the political editor here at NPR News. Ken, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Neil.
And Mara Liasson, national political correspondent for NPR. Mara, always a pleasure to have you with us as well.
Hello, Neil.
And Mara, I wanted to ask you, the president spent, well, I'd say about two-thirds of the speech on the economy and jobs. Was that the right focus?
It certainly was. This is what voters are saying they care about. They care about it almost to the exclusion of everything else. One of the problems that the president faced with his health care proposal is that voters felt it was taking over, that it was crowding out a focus on the things that they cared about more, which was jobs and the economy. I think that this was in large measure the speech that he had planned to give even before the Massachusetts Senate election. He'd always planned a pivot to the economy, to a more relentless focus on jobs, and that's what you got tonight. The fact that he's talking about small business, tax cuts and tax credits, I think he's trying to craft a jobs bill that could get some Republican support. You heard Vin Weber say some of these things are appealing. But, you know, one of the most anticipated moments in the speech was about health care. People were waiting to see what he would say. Don't forget, right after the election in Massachusetts, he seemed to signal a retreat. Maybe we should go back to core elements that are popular, something smaller. But he didn't do that tonight. He said, don't walk away. We're very close. Let's finish the job. And he said to Republicans, if you have a better approach, fine, but it has to do the following things, which are the Democrats' goals, bringing down premiums, covering the uninsured, bringing down the deficits, stopping insurance company abuses. So it looks like he's going to push ahead on that.
And Ken Rudin, yes, he's going to push ahead on that. But as we've heard earlier, he didn't exactly say how he was going to get from here to there.
No, and that's the thing that I think we were all waiting for as well. I mean, for him to say, let's get it done, well, he's been saying that for months. Remember that famous address to the joint session of Congress last September, the famous Joe Wilson outburst when you lie. I mean, the rhetoric was almost exactly word for word the same, that what's at stake, and there are people who are losing their coverage, and there are people who are suffering, and there are people who was going bankrupt because of health care, and yet nothing, you know, was different. I thought that there might have been some kind of a lesson coming out of Massachusetts, for better or for worse, but I didn't hear it. I think what I did hear was a little bit of a lecture. I mean, I still think the speech he gives is better than anybody else, but it seemed like the lecture, you know, to the Republican Party, just saying no, it may be good politics, but it's not leadership. That's true, but again, I need to know how you get from here to there, and let's get it done is not the way to get there.
Let's get another caller in on the conversation. Juanita calling from Kingston in Washington.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Juanita. Go ahead, please.
Hi. You know, the part that really hit me was calling accountability to the CEOs and the bank bailout. You know, a lot of us are struggling, and I think we lose faith because it's a similar situation to having your best friend borrow money for diapers and groceries and a gallon of milk and then calling you, telling you what a good time they're having on their vacation in Hawaii. You know, I think it just, you know, so many of us are burned on the fact that a lot of us are struggling, and there are people that are already rich, and they're still continuing to, you know, to take the money. And as far as I'm concerned, you're just taking it right out of my pocket.
So you like the part where he said we need to impose a what he called a modest fee on the banks to get some of that money back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I just feel like, you know, we talk a lot about the American people pulling together, and in our little neighborhoods here, a lot of us are doing that. We're doing without. We're helping each other. And, you know, the thing that, above all the big issues, the thing that just irks you on the core level is that the greedy continue to be so greedy and get away with it.
There was also, I need to point out, Juanita, there was mention of the bailout of the banks, and he said this was something that was necessary. He had to, when he came into office, follow up on the policies of the previous administration or risk what everybody on both sides of the aisle was fearing was a major, major depression.
And if there's one thing that has unified Democrats and Republicans and everybody in between, it's that we all hated the bank bailout. I hated it. I hated it. I hated it. You hated it. It was about as popular as a root canal. But when I ran for president, I promised I wouldn't just do what was popular. I would do what was necessary.
And I wonder, Juanita, did that convince you?
You know, I felt like he was handed a bag of dirty laundry for sure. I mean, but I agree. We all hated it. It was a necessary evil. Nobody likes it. But, you know, the salt in the wound was, you know, for me, looking past a lot of the smaller issues is just, you know, certain things bother you more than others. And when somebody's paying themselves, you know, and their CEOs billions and billions of dollars and they haven't even gotten out of the dirty water yet, it's just crazy to me. And it's the thing that makes you lose faith. You just feel like the whole system is so corrupt that it's never going to fix itself. So I was just really glad that that was addressed.
Juanita, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Here's an email we have from Lourdes in Seattle. Good to hear focus on jobs and the economy, but how long is Obama going to keep hauling out Bush every time he gives a speech? Also, I know we all hate the Wall Street bailout. Why has the president conveniently forgotten the automakers bailout? But anyway, getting back to that first point, Mara Liasson, the president did take time to go back and say, let me remind you what I inherited.
He did. And you know, it's funny because in polls, including a poll that NPR recently took, when people are asked, was this his mess or did he inherit it? People say he inherited it by big majorities. But at this point, I think the statute of limitations for blaming Bush is running out because people hold him responsible for the solution. I mean, people might agree that he didn't happen on his watch. But I don't think that's necessarily gonna buy him any more forbearance with the public about fixing the problem. You know, I think it's really interesting. You know, Ken talked about the lack in this speech of exactly how he's going to pass health care. The fact is the White House and the Democrats don't know yet how they're going to do it. And that is what people inside the Beltway are waiting and watching for. I certainly was. But I do think that this speech was packed full of kind of crowd-pleasing lines, and you heard the last caller talk approvingly about his bashing of the banks and Wall Street and talking about jobs and tax credits for jobs. So I think that this is kind of a classic midterm election year State of the Union speech where you pivot, you try to put out a lot of ideas that are going to be popular with the public because the president has a lot of repair work to do for himself and his party.
Let's get Ann on the line. Ann with us from Milwaukee.
You know, all these really substantive things that I'm hearing are wonderful. But you said, what did we like and what did we not like? I loved it that he marched out there and he said, I think it's going to be better. It's going to be okay. I think that was very healing. It was a great start for a speech. And I also enjoyed watching Nancy Pelosi and the vice president up there. They seemed like real people.
Wasn't that an interesting shot, Anne, to see an African-American president flanked on either side by a white man and a white woman?
And they're so patrician. I mean, I know the vice president really isn't, but he looks kind of elegant.
And he'll tell you about his background from Scranton if you give him a chance.
Yeah.
Or if you don't.
It was a good tone or something to it. I liked that very much.
And Ken Rudin, you were saying earlier, the president can certainly rely on his oratorical gifts, and those were certainly in evidence this evening.
They were.
Oh, absolutely.
And I guess I have to admire him for not... I know that he's reminding us about Bush and things, but I think he's maintaining the equilibrium that he needs. I think he's keeping his balance.
Ken, he seemed to be having a good time.
Well, he certainly, as he points out, he does have the numbers, and the Democrats have more senators, like 59 now, than they have since the late 1970s. So they certainly should get something done. But several points I want to make quickly. I disagree a little bit with Mara and when she said that the state of limitations on blaming George W. Bush for what's going on is over. I don't think that's the case, because it's only been 1 year in the presidency. Yes, the voters do see that it's a Democratic majority in Congress and it's a Democratic president. But ultimately, he's going to have to make the case that there's no way that to solve these problems, just like the depression wasn't solved in the first year of FDR. As a matter of fact, it took him 8 years, if not more, to even start to make some case headway against the depression. But also something Juanita said earlier, and I think this is a bit behind what the Tea Party is all about. It's not anti-democratic and yet pro-Republican. It's just a disgust with the way things are going. And if somehow the Democrats could take hold of this populist outrage that the Republicans have been so successful of doing, as we saw in Virginia, as we saw in New Jersey, and as we saw last week in Massachusetts, then their losses in 2010, the Democratic losses, may not be as bad as they think it will be.
We'll have to see about that. Voters do tend to blame the party that's in power if things don't go well.
Oh, no doubt about it. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. That's exactly what's happening now. I mean, Democrats have more incumbents, and they're the ones who are going to bear the brunt of the voter anger and frustration. I mean, Ken knows better than anybody that the first midterm for a party that holds Congress and the White House, I think the average is something like 25 seats lost. So they're facing a pretty tough hill to climb. What they're trying to do is minimize those losses and hang on to control of both houses of Congress.
And thanks so much for the phone call. Appreciate it. Here's an email that we have from Anthony. How wonderful that we have someone leading the way to secure nuclear weapons material. That was part of the president's speech. He said they are working toward a comprehensive agreement with Russia on nuclear weapons and would try to work together with the nations of the world to secure all nuclear materials within the next 4 years. Anthony continues, we do know how important this is. Huge. I noticed the military did not clap or get up either time he mentioned ending the war or getting troops out of Iraq. They only stood up when the president mentioned supporting troops when they came home. This isn't good foreboding. Shows he's got some resistance. Well, in fact, Anthony, they did not get up then either. It is the tradition in the military, the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who attend these State of the Union messages every year, they don't get up to applaud anything, just like the Supreme Court doesn't get up to applaud anything either, no matter which president appointed them. But I wanted to go on to one part of the speech, Mara Liasson, that is going to be parsed for its language, and that was the president's call to bring an end to the practice of don't ask, don't tell.
This year, I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are.
And this is something that's been in the president's quiver throughout his campaign, brought out a year after he's been in office. But is there any ground been prepared for this?
Well, this is something that certainly his gay supporters feel is long overdue. And the White House broadcast that it would be doing this, they did. Now, whether this is actually going to happen, I don't know. But this is kind of a a debt that he owed the gay community. He said he was going to do it, and he finally did today. Everything got a little bit of a mention, you know, immigration reform, energy, don't ask, don't tell. But this came very, very, very late in a very long speech on page 13 of 14 in my transcript.
Mm-hmm. Penelope in Ridgecrest, California, wrote on this point, "I did like his statement that he would work with Congress to repeal the law that limits the service of gays and lesbians. However, I thought he could have written an executive order when he came into office first to right this wrong." And Ken, that's been the position of a lot of people who thought they helped the president get elected.
Well, that's I was saying the exact same thing when he said it. Let's do this. Let's talk to Congress. I will deal with Congress. But just like with health care, there are deadlines and then there are no deadlines. There wasn't even a deadline regarding Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They said, I would like to have this done and I'll talk to them this year, but that's as far as we got.
All right. Ken Rudin is with us. He's NPR's political editor, joining us from his home. Also with us, Mara Liasson, national political correspondent for NPR. After listening to the politicians and pundits, this is your opportunity to weigh in. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, or zap us an email, talk@npr.org. Let's read a couple of those emails before we come away for a short break. Joe writes, it was a cut-and-paste speech, long on what, short on how. Martha in Elmendorf, Texas wrote, I have a young son and daughter-in-law who just bought a home using the $8,000 stimulus rebate. My son is saddled with a large college debt 10 years after he graduated. I am hopeful that there will be help for him so he can save for his future and retirement. It sounded like our president had an idea to help him with that. I would appreciate a little talk about that. We'll try to get back to it after a short break. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News in Washington. I'm Neil Conan. Tonight we heard from President Obama in his first State of the Union address, speaking at a joint meeting of Congress in the Capitol. We also heard from Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, the newly elected governor of Virginia, speaking to his legislature in Virginia, who invoked Thomas Jefferson while making the Republican response to the president's speech and the familiar theme of small government. If you listen to the State of the Union address or the Republican response, tell us what you liked, what you didn't. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. With us are NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson and NPR political editor Ken Rudin. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Luke. Luke with us from Appleton in Wisconsin.
Well, hi. As if health care isn't important enough. I mean, you lose your benefits because you have the audacity to get sick, not to have hope to recover. The president said no one should go broke because they want to go to college, quote unquote. What struck me about that is because obviously the GI Bill enabled how many of our veterans after World War II to go on and lead this country, and I know Bob Dole is certainly one of them, and I think President Bush the First is another one. I mean, how can we not deny these? How can we deny these people, our generation, you know, to go to college? I mean, I think Bob Dole should have been out in the audience and instead of advertising for Viagra.
Well, I'm not sure that contract is still active. And I'm not sure that President George H.W. Bush needed the GI Bill to pay his way through Yale. But this is nevertheless something that the president has focused on a lot in his first term. And he specifically mentioned tonight, Mara, that there's been a vast increase in spending on veterans and taking care of the troops who are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting. He has proposing a three-year spending freeze for non-defense discretionary programs. However, he is expecting a big increase in money to education. And the White House knows very well that education is one of those things that people are willing to spend money on, and they do see it as an economic investment. That's why so much a big chunk of the speech was about education, taking the money that would go from taxpayer subsidies to banks that provide student loans and applying it to give families a $10,000 tax credit for 4 years of college, increasing Pell Grants, telling students that when they graduate, they'll only have to pay 10% of their income on student loans, and that all of their debt will be forgiven after 20 years and after 10 if they choose a career in public service. So I think that that's one of the things you'll hear the president talk a lot about this year: jobs, deficit reduction, education.
And in jobs, we should note he mentioned he's going to Tampa, Florida tomorrow to announce that some of the stimulus money will be spent on a high-speed rail that will run between Orlando and Tampa, perhaps also on high-speed rail projects in the Midwest and on the West Coast as well. Jobs which may not show up for a little while, but nevertheless, that's what he's going to be talking about. Let's go next to Adrian. Adrian with us from Manhattan in New York.
Yes, good evening. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I'm a little confused about a lot of what I hear, which I consider to be just rhetoric and politics. For example, I have a small company, not a big company, and I've had to let pretty much all of my staff go. I have a lease, commercial lease with Cushman and Wakefield, which I basically have to pay out of my own pocket to keep the company afloat. They don't care. They basically have let half of the building go if they can't pay the full rent. And you listen to the speech, and it says, we're putting money back into the economy for small businesses to get them back going. So I email my accountant, and I say, where can I get money to hire my secretary back? Reply back for him, from him? No idea. So, for example, I think it's just a lot of wonderful conversation to get people applauding, but at the end of the day, nothing's really happening.
One thing he did describe was a policy that would free up more money for loans to small businesses.
But that's baloney, too, because you go to your bank and say, I would like to get a loan. First thing they're going to say is collateral.
Ken Rudin, is this just showing off? Is this empty rhetoric? Let's hear from Ken Rudin.
Well, it's rhetoric. I mean, it's the kind of stuff, as the Nobel Peace Prize Committee would tell you, that they believe in this potential, and they believe, and I think the Democrats in the Obama administration believes very strongly that not only would the stimulus package was a success, but it could lead to even greater success. And of course, Vice President Biden, among others, have said that we even need a bigger stimulus package. The fact is that by the time President Obama finished his speech tonight, the 10% unemployment number will not go away. And matter of fact, it could very well increase. There's a feeling in the administration that it will improve. The financial and employment situation in the country will improve. The political question, of course, is whether these people will feel that it's improving enough to vote Democratic in November, and that's the big if in this year's politics.
And that's an interesting point, Adrian. It sounds like you're very upset and might go Republican.
I'm not upset. I just, for example, think it's a lot of... I'm not a boxer, but for example, when you go into a ring, presumably when you go to box, you go to hit your opponent. But if you're just boxing and shadowing, eventually the crowd start booing because the boxers are not really interacting. And that's what I think is what's going on here. It's easy to say, I'm going to put money into the system tomorrow. I'm going to flood 10% back from what we got from Wall Street to get small businesses running. Okay, fine. So I get up tomorrow, put my suit on. Where do I go to knock on the door and say, there's my business, there's my certificate from New York to say that I'm a legitimate business, there's my certificate of number from the Department of Small Business in New York, I'm legitimate. Where can I sign to get that stimulus so I can deposit in my business account, call my ex-secretary, have her come back, start putting her back on salary? It's all hot air. And, you know, the other thing about Obama, he turns around and criticizes the Supreme Court with their decision with regards to how people can start giving money for the next election. Meanwhile, before he became president, he was, because I live in Manhattan and I know a lot of people, he was at George Soros' apartment night after night after night. Where do you think he got that money from?
All right,
Everybody takes...
Adrian, come on, let's give somebody else a chance, okay? Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it. Here's some emails, and this from George on health care. Stood his ground on health care despite the negative attacks on health care that have been successful. Leaders lead, they don't follow. A change from the stick your finger in the air leadership in Washington. A correction by Billy in Baltimore. The Joint Chiefs did indeed stand when taking care of returning troops was mentioned. I'll have to check that. He may be right. This from Paul, who said, I think President Obama is right that there must be bipartisanship to get the best possible future, but it seemed to me that he indulged in the opportunity to grind a few things in Republican faces tonight. Must must change his approach a little if he wants to lead by example on this. And here's a little bit of what the president had to say on that, where he noted that it is an election year, but we do need to govern.
The Democrats, I would remind you that we still have the largest majority in decades, and the people expect us to solve problems, not run for the hills. And if the Republican leadership is going to insist that 60 votes in the Senate are required to do any business at all in this town, a supermajority, then the responsibility to govern is now yours as well. Just saying no to everything may be good short-term politics, but it's not leadership. We were sent here to serve our citizens, not our ambitions.
And Ken Rudin, in addition to chiding the Republicans on that, who got more chiding, I think, than the Democrats did in that particular exchange, I was struck by the number of times the president turned to the Senate tonight and said, the House has passed a bill on this. Let's hear from the United States Senate.
Well, that's what's so fascinating, because we could blame the Republicans all we want, and we know the Republicans were unanimously opposed, all 40, then 40 Republicans were opposed to the president's health care initiatives, but we could blame the Republicans all we want, but the fact is that the Democrats had 60 votes since last summer, I guess since Arlen Specter switched and since Al Franken was seated. And, you know, they were the demands of separate Democrats, the Joe Liebermans, the Ben Nelsons, the Blanche Lincolns, the Mary Landrews of the world. Had they, I don't want to sound judgmental here, but had they decided to vote for the bill for the common good of the Democratic Party and the Obama administration and not gone after their selfish interests, they wouldn't have to have such a shocking wake-up call when Scott Brown won in Massachusetts. They had the votes, they could have passed it. So we could blame the Republicans all we want, but Democrats have to take some responsibility for its so far defeat as well.
And this not just on health care, but on the energy and other issues as well. Let's get another caller on the line. This is SR, XR calling us from Oxnard in California.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, please.
Let me say, first of all, I did not vote for Barack Obama, but I found this speech to restore or start a little bit of a hope. One thing I disagreed with him on was the nuclear...
The agreement with Russia?
No. The nuclear power.
Starting more nuclear power plants.
Right. I think that it just is too dangerous in the long run. And he didn't mention Iran and that nuclear problem, but I think that in the same context with the working with Russia, that we ought to be trying to completely disarm the Mideast in terms of nuclear power, which means very unpopularly telling Israel, hey, you know, you can't have it anymore.
He did not mention that. He did not directly address the issue of Iran's nuclear ambitions.
He did
speak very specifically, Mara Liasson, about that Iran leadership, if they did not become more cooperative, and this was specifically, I think, on the nuclear issue, would be facing new and sterner sanctions.
That's right. And that's been the administration's position all along, that they tried engagement, and if that doesn't work, there's going to be real sanctions, and that remains to be seen, whether he's going to get international cooperation for that to design a regime of sanctions that really bites. You know, I just wanted to go back for a second to something that Ken said earlier, which is so important. The fact that the Democrats have had 60 votes and they failed to pass their own president's top domestic priority in his first year in office. I think that when I imagine Republicans having a similar majority or maybe less, it's almost unthinkable that they would have failed to do this. I do think that it's just an incredible indictment of the Democratic leadership in Congress that they couldn't get health care done, that there were Christmas Eve votes, and that into the president's second year, it still isn't finished. Now, you could also say the White House didn't crack the whip early enough. They were involved every step of the way, but the president never put his foot down and said enough. They knew all along that the longer it's hung out there, the less popular it was getting.
And that's just what I wanted to mention. We kept talking all last summer and all last fall that there was, in effect, a deadline on this. If it didn't
pass...
There
were many deadlines.
Well,
many deadlines.
But a political deadline. If it didn't pass by the first of the year, it was going to run into a lot of trouble in the election year. It came in a way nobody really expected in Massachusetts, but nevertheless, those predictions have come true.
I think that the Democrats are suffering, and the president is suffering, not just because the substance of the health care bill has become unpopular, but the fact is it didn't pass. It did hang out there for a long time. People got really disgusted by the sausage-making process that they saw and the special deals. But it was a very badly managed process. And the fact is every Democrat understood that that passing this thing was the most important thing. They had many, many years to fix it later. But it became a really awful spectacle of I think, Democratic indiscipline.
Can I just add one thing to this? We know what the president didn't do. We know what the Democrats didn't do. The question is where they go from here. We saw after Bill Clinton and the Democrats took this tremendous defeat in 1994 when Republicans won both houses of Congress, the president decided to change his tactics, reach out more to the Republicans. Of course, there were more Republicans then, and there were probably more Republicans who were more receptive to it. But by doing that, it enabled him to turn his presidency around and win re-election. The question is whether President Obama repeats that strategy.
Triangulation, I don't think, is an option for this president because he doesn't have Congress being run by the opposite party.
Well,
who's he going to triangulate
with? That could change in November. But anyway,
that could change in November.
Let's get Bill on the line calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello, Neil.
Yes, go ahead, please.
What I see here from Congress is a complete abdication of responsibility. And as an example, I think that the health care situation is an indictment of Congress to act responsibly to something that's clearly needed. Health care costs are escalating. Our costs are remarkably expensive compared to the rest of the developed world. And I am remarkably distressed in the congressional performance in much of the last year, actually much of the last 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, well, no matter which party was in power. Bill, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We've just got a few minutes left. And Mara and Ken, I wanted to turn to you both to say, as the president moves ahead from here, he may have done himself some good, but the ratings for these kinds of political speeches are not what they used to be. And it's not likely the president swayed a whole bunch of public opinion this evening. He may have laid down a few markers, but he is still banking, it seems to me, on passage of health care and moving on from that. And that's a frail reed at this point.
I actually disagree with that a little bit. I think healthcare is in a timeout right now. At the White House, they're talking about catching our breath, reassessing what's doable, what's passable. I don't think that healthcare is going to hold up the rest of the agenda. I think that he's going to move forward on the jobs bill. That's his number one priority this year. They're certainly going to try to see if they can get healthcare done, whether it's some combination of reconciliation and the House passing the Senate bill. But I think that the president is going to turn his focus to jobs and the economy almost exclusively.
Well, again, noting he is going to Tampa to talk about jobs tomorrow. Okay. Ken?
We saw President Bill Clinton give a great first State of the Union speech in 1994. His numbers at that time were 60% approval ratings. They even went up after the speech, and his party lost control of Congress months later. So we can talk about great speeches. We can talk about great rhetoric. Ultimately, something has to get done, and if it's not, the party in power will suffer.
We'll give the last word to a few emailers. This from Larry Oki. I supported and contributed to Obama's campaign because of his brilliant oratory. Alas, it appears that oratory is all there is to this president. I find it difficult to imagine that his glowing plans will be accomplished anytime soon when, out of the other side of the mouth, he implies a discretionary spending freeze. Can't have it both ways. It's got to be one or the other. And judging by his results to date, I'm guessing it's going to be the other, read spending freeze, and no action. This from Helene in Boston. The biggest blow to my spirits recently is the decision of the Supreme Court, so I'm very pleased that he stood up to the Supreme Court. Bravo on that. Good job. I was exhilarated by the upbeat tone of his message and his can-do stance in these very uncertain and difficult times. I'm very glad he will continue to pursue goals that will benefit the nation, such as a green economy, universal health care that will not bankrupt our budget by giveaways to big insurance, and regulation of the finance industry. And this from Joanne. I felt his speech tonight was a complete giveaway to the Republicans. Everybody knows clean coal is a fantasy and that education reform is Republican code for privatizing public funds toward a profit for profit education. The kicker was when he evoked Reagan along with JFK as a role model. That was when he spoke about control of nuclear strategic weapons. So we thank everybody who emailed and called us this evening. We're sorry we could not get to all of your emails and calls. We should note we received over 100 emails over the past hour, over half of them frustrated with the lack of bipartisanship in Congress. Our thanks as well to Mara Liasson, NPR political correspondent here in Washington, D.C. Mara, thank you very much. I hope that cough gets better.
Thank you, Neil.
And Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, who joined us from his home as well. Ken, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Stay tuned to NPR News tomorrow morning for much more analysis of the State of the Union message, the Republican response, and the public response as well. I'm Neil Conan. You've been listening to special coverage from NPR News.